Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and every major podcast provider. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use our free podcast player, which is available on our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or simply call into the show at area code 917-932-1068. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today, I'm going to be talking to William Park, who's the founder of EcoOla, which is a model for modern ecological farming. I mean, this farm is really, really amazing. People talk about sustainability all the time, but often they don't really walk the walk. I mean, it's great to think about it, but when you have somebody who actually is doing it, who is taking so many different components and putting them together to not only take care of the earth and work with the environment, as well as the different products that come from that particular area, but actually work with the community. It's really, really fantastic. And that's exactly what EcoOla does. So today, I have the founder, Mr. William Park, and we're going to talk about what it takes to create a truly sustainable farm while maintaining harmony with the community. So I would like to welcome to the show William Park. Good afternoon, William, and welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. Now, can you tell our audience about yourself and what made you decide that you were going to head down to Peru and create this whole amazing farm?
Well, it all started when I really just wanted to go and see the biodiversity and the amazing forest of the Amazon. And so I started going to take backpacking trips and as a tourist in Peru. And as I got more and more interested in, the rainforest, and then, I saw the great potential for, helping the communities. And, I really just fell in love with the people, so hardworking, great people, and saw that, that they were, really struggling in many ways. And I saw that they had so many incredible products, like Sachi Inchi and things that people weren't aware of in the States. And I saw that there was a great potential there to both help the communities in the Amazon and provide, unique and incredibly healthy products for people in the United States.
Now, William, can you talk about the types of products, the staples that the community grows? Because, I mean, you're talking about some foods that many people, especially here in America, are not familiar with, but are rapidly discovering the nutritional value. And, I mean, these different foods are amazing. And what makes them so amazing is because there's so many different elements that are not only nutritious, but have different attributes that can help maintain good health.
Right, so one of our principal crops is Sacha Inchi, which is a vine that's native to the forests of Peru. And it's really incredible because it has 33% protein and it's about 50% omega content. And of that, the majority is omega-3, which is really essential for all cellular and metabolic processes. And it's these are called essential fatty acids because your body can't synthesize them, by itself. So they have to be obtained from your diet. And so Sacha Inchi is really rich in omega-3s and also fiber, vitamin A, vitamin E, and lots of important minerals like calcium and magnesium.
One of the things that I found with the Sacha Inchi, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, Sacha Inchi.
Sacha Inchi, especially with the nuts, I'm very grateful that you were able to send me some of the toasted Sacha Inchi seeds. And I find that they have the same flavor as freshly grown organic sugar snap peas. And for those folks that are really big lover of garden fresh vegetables, there's nothing like the flavor, and it's such a great snack, not to mention all the wonderful nutritional value. But can you talk about what made you decide that you were going to focus on growing this particular seed?
Well, we wanted something that would really benefit people in the States, and that would had nutrients that people were lacking, and people are really looking for sources of omega-3s. And at the time there were a lot of issues with contamination of fish oil products, and also people worried about depletion of the oceans. And my mother-in-law actually gave me some sacha inchi, and I was eating it. I said, "This is delicious. What is it? Sacha inchi." And then I started looking into it, and at the time it was generally the vines were in the Amazon basically just grown as kitchen vines, and people would just have a couple of vines in their backyards, and they would just harvest their own. And since then, there's much more commercial cultivation of sacha inchi. Our sacha inchi is really unique because we produce it in an agroforestry system.
Is it grown in other parts of the continent, or is it just something that's particularly found in Peru?
Yes, I mean, it's also cultivated in Colombia, Ecuador, and Bolivia, and it was used by the Incas, and so in some of the ancient Inca artworks, you can see the star-shaped, very distinctive star-shaped seed pod of sacha inchi depicted. And so it's a traditional food of the Incas, of course, whose capital was Cusco in Peru.
Do you know of any traditional or ceremonial uses for the sacha inchi? I'm just curious because I know that there are many folks out there who really appreciate the historical value.
Well, I was very interested to find out. I had the real privilege to go visit the Matseis, or the cat people, a tribe that lives in the frontier between Peru and Brazil, in an area of the Galvez River, a very remote part of the Amazon, and to discover that they cultivate sacha inchi, and they actually mash the seeds up, and they have a special ceremonial hollowed-out log they use, of a very hard type of wood, and they use that to mash the sacha inchi, and then they toast it, and they eat that, and they have a ceremony that is involved with that. But they also use the protein and lipids to supplement their diets at a time of high water when there's very little fish available. So they use it as an alternative for meat during times when it's difficult to obtain fish.
Now, William, can you make the sacha inchi into any type of a protein powder or anything like that? Can you talk about that?
Yes. So what we do is we make mechanically pressed sacha inchi oil. So no, we don't use any expellers or anything at all. It's just actually mechanically pressed extra virgin oil. And then the leftover, the mash, we sift and turn into a protein powder. And once some of the oils are removed, so it has around 50% protein, and then it still has some of the lipids in it, and then as well as lots of fiber, the vitamins and minerals. And it's really important that for your body to heal, you need a combination of protein and lipids together. When you have the right balance of protein and lipid, that's what really allows your muscles to repair themselves and your body to heal. And so some of the latest research that's been done, particularly by geriatricians and those focusing on people recovering from trauma and injury, have shown that that's what's really important. And that's one of the really great things about sacha inchi protein powder, is it has both the lipid and the protein.
Can you talk about the actual growing process? Are there any types of chemical use, or is this strictly organic?
Yeah, we're kind of in the category of beyond organic. So where we're working, there's been the land has really been devastated. So the trees have all been cut down, and then cattle have been brought in, and the land has been overgrazed. So we're really starting with almost nothing, kind of clay. And so we start by breaking that clay up, and then planting cover crops, and we develop a system that includes the planting of the sachienchi, so that what was once kind of a highly degraded and non-productive space grows into a highly productive triple canopy food forest. So in other words, you plant trees that provide for fruit, fuel, different uses for the trees, and underneath that you have the vines, the sachienchi, and then underneath the sachienchi have other staples like the yucca and peppers, beans, and other crops. So they all grow together, and that's kind of the essence of what a agroforestry system is.
In regards to the land itself, that is very challenging when you're working with land that has been completely devastated, and especially if it's been reduced to clay. So are you using any type of any different types of amendments, such as compost, to try to restore the quality of the soil? Because it's very difficult. It's also very time-consuming to rebuild that soil. And I'm just curious, what are some of the practices that you've been implementing?
Yeah, so the first issue is erosion. So we're working in the rainforest, so there are very, very strong rains that come. And so before you can really do anything, you have to address the erosion issue. And we do that by constructing swales. And swales are basically mounds that are dug, and they're put on contour, so that when the rains come, the water can't flow downhill, and it's caught in the swale and actually soaks back into the hill slope. And then during times of low rain, then that water becomes available for the roots of the plant. So that's the first step. Then the next step is to break up the clay. And so we use cover crops, nitrogen-fixing cover crops, to begin to break up the clay with, the roots physically break up the clay. And then they also add nitrogen, so in preparation for planting, the yucca, bananas, beans, and all the other crops we grow. And then, once that's done, then, the sachienchi and everything can grow well. And then the idea is building what people call plant guilds. So in other words, plants that actually help each other grow. So the old idea that you have to clear everything out of the way and only one type of plant can grow in one area. And if you plant anything else, it competes with the plant for your crop for nutrients. And so that's not really the case if you have a well-designed system where the plants actually benefit each other. So the plants have a commensal relationship, and each plant growing in proximity to each other benefits from the presence of the other plant, and therefore you have a more yield and less work. And that's the idea of developing polycultures.
And it's also very beneficial as a companion plant to keep out, or to ward off rather, any predatory insects or anything that might want to eat the plants. So that's a really smart move.
And we have, where we are, there are many, many leaf cutter ants, which are, can do incredible amounts of crop damage. And so that's something that in the tropics always has to be addressed. And so we've found that, simply by planting lemongrass, that leaf cutter ants don't like to cross the lemongrass. So by having rows of lemongrass not only helps, trap nutrients and prevent, erosion, and, it makes incredible tea and cooking, and it has many uses, but it also deters the leaf cutter ants. So that's been very useful. And there are other plants, a local plant, which is related to sugarcane, Acania brava, and that also helps to deter the leaf cutter ants. And then there are also certain types of plants that they really like. And so just through observation, then taking the plants that they really like and kind of allowing those to grow and uncultivated areas away from your crop, then the leaf cutters can focus over there and do their thing. And the leaf cutters are really beneficial because, as long as you don't let them eat your whole crop, because they're underground, they're farmers in their own right. So they take the leaves and they bring them and they grow fungi underneath the ground and they're feed their young. And when they're done and they abandon the nest, that really helps to enrich the soil. So the leaf cutters are a vital part of the ecosystem. And so it'd be impossible to get rid of them, and it wouldn't really be beneficial in the long run to get rid of them either. So it's kind of a way to coexist with them.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because most people don't really understand that when you're farming, it's not just about what you're sowing, but what's under the soil or what's in the soil as well. And the fact that you're acknowledging beneficial insects that are actually helping you to rebuild the soil is fantastic, because that's something about sustainable agriculture that many people seem to overlook. People tend to notice the problems with different insects that might eat the vegetation, or predatory animals, or just animals that happen to live in that particular region. But the fact that you're looking at these insects as beneficial to the rebuilding, if you will, of the topsoil is tremendous. Now, just out of curiosity, what do you use for fertilizer?
We make our own compost. And so we have a water buffalo, and we're actually really pleased that our water buffalo are some of the first working water buffalo in the region of Loreto, where our farms are. And so the water buffalo provide cheese. So the families milk the water buffalo and they make fresh buffalo cheese. And then the animals also work. And then their manure is a very important part of our compost. So we have a type of worm that really thrives in buffalo manure. So we have a bin with the worms, and then we also compost a lot of other organic material and aquatic plants that we skim off of the ponds and then mix that together to get the right carbon nitrogen ratio to make a really nice compost.
What type of compost, compost systems have you developed for the farm? Are you just building bins and then just turning them, or what exactly are you doing?
Well, we have mounds. So, our farms are fairly large. So, one site is, 20 acres. So for a size that, having bins, it's not, we need a lot of compost. So we need,
of course,
tons of compost. So we just use big piles and then turn them. And then oftentimes we dig a trench under the pile to help with aeration, and then we turn periodically, as needed to make sure it all, cooks properly.
Thank you. I just want you to explain to our audience the type of mechanical equipment that you're not using and why.
Well, where we are is so remote, so it makes the transport of heavy equipment very difficult, and also the price of the fuel and the quality of the fuel is very high, so that's a limitation. So we have to kind of improvise, adapt, and overcome in terms of using equipment. But we do have basic equipment, tillers, weed cutters, and we do have some very basic equipment we use. But we also use the buffalo, of course, for helping to build the swales and they're transporting stuff. We have a very small three-wheeled tractor that we use to carry stuff. So we have to get by with minimal equipment because of the remoteness of the location.
Is it all manually operated? I mean, is any of the equipment operated through fossil fuel, or is it strictly all manpower and animal power, should I say?
No. No, we do have equipment, you know, like the tillers and some of the other things that we use that do run on gasoline. And so what we're doing is we have a partner, that is doing a lot of research in terms of producing highly efficient bioethanol. And so we have plans to take all of our farm waste and use that to make our own ethanol. And then in that way, we can run all our equipment and all our transport off of our own ethanol. So that's something that's in the work. But in the short term, we just have to use small amounts of gasoline to power some of the tools we use.
That's fantastic. And in regards to electricity, can you share with our audience how even this interview is even being conducted? I mean, I'm so amused right now that I'm here in New York and you're in Peru, and you're not even using the same technology that I'm using, but this interview is taking place. So can you share with our audience exactly what you're doing?
Well, on the farm, what we do is when we need to, recharge things, or we, for the families when they want to, have lights, at night, they actually are still using a generator. Because where we are, there's no electrical grid. So everything has to be run off a generator. And then when they use electricity, and that's another purpose for the bioethanol, is that we're going to purchase some ethanol-optimized generators in order to generate our own electricity.
Now, how, in regards to the actual farm itself, with the amount of energy that you're using, compared to some of the other farms that produce as much as you do, what would you say the amount of energy that you use is as opposed to what they use?
Must be less than 10%.
Really mind-blowing, isn't it, that here you are in such a remote area and you're able to produce all these different crops and truly work with the community in a way that is not only sustainable but also lends itself to the history of the area?
Yeah, the area where we're working, about an hour outside of the city of Iquitos, is a mixture. So some of the community members are people that have just come out of the jungle. So, their grandparents or even their parents were, mostly hunter-gatherers, and now they've come closer to the city. Other community members were actually displaced during the Fujimori era and, conflict in Peru. And so they were displaced from the mountains by the conflict, and they're settlers in the Amazon. And so there's a mix of both those people. And so the people from the mountains are, have their own, farming traditions, but because the environment is so different, some of those, different crops, different techniques, so they're not able to really apply their traditional methods entirely to the Amazon. And the people that, the indigenous Amazonian community members didn't, they really lost their farming traditions. And so, that's the great thing about the agroforestry and the permaculture is that, that we're able to, work with them and share with them these techniques, which are, largely based on, traditional and older farming methods, with scientific, innovation mixed in. And so, that's what makes it so rewarding is that we can share these techniques with the people and really help them to become self-sufficient.
Thank you. William, how many people live on the farm, and how many people actually work on the farm?
Well, we have, extended families that, live on the farm, so our partner farmers, and so there are a number of families there, and then we also employ workers who come from the community and work with us, and project really is as the people work with us, and we can train them so they can earn a living while they're getting trained in how to, produce the crops, and then they can start their farming for themselves. So go back to their own small farms and then start producing, and that way, you know, we can expand and, you know, the people can, you know, get the training they need and also, you know, maintain their income.
And do you have any multi-generational families living or working at the farm?
No. You know, the community is relatively new where we are, so it was an area that was mostly logged, and now there's a small settlement there. And so most of the families are new. Some of the families are Yagua Indian, and so that the area is part of their traditional territory. And so people, Yagua communities, as you know, they face so many challenges in their, you know, in the jungle. They many of them leave to come to the city, and so some of those people are, you know, have settled in Masan, where we work. And so we're working with those people. We're very interested in expanding our work with Yagua communities further upriver. But the settlement is relatively new, and it's not, they're not really multi-generational families there.
Are there any other farms that have set up similar structures as you have, or is this something that you've been thinking about for quite a while and finally had an opportunity to make it come about?
Yeah, there. I mean, there's a network of permaculturists and agroforestry farms. A lot of them are teaching farms and, you know, very small farms. So I think ours is pretty unique, at least in the region, and in size, you know, because we have, you know, well over 100 acres where we're working, and, you know, and we're also, you know, it's a production farm, it's not a teaching farm, so, you know, we, you know, everything is geared towards, really, you know, production. And then, let me say, of that 100 acres, of course, you know, that's part of the permaculture, agroforestry techniques, is, you know, we don't just plant, you know, sachi inchi, you know, border to border. I mean, there are areas, you know, where we select for planting sachi inchi. Then there are other areas that we just allow to just grow naturally. And so there are different ways that the land is used.
Do you have any issues that you think, or rather, let me ask it this way. When it comes to some of the common problems with agriculture, do you think that the method that you are using is better at avoiding some of the more common issues than if you had just farmed conventionally?
Well, absolutely. I mean, because, you know, farming, you know, conventionally, I mean, is really just getting on a chemical treadmill. So, you know, you can get big yields right away if you have a monoculture, and then as the, you know, particularly in the tropics, you know, you end up getting into you know, a chemical warfare situation with the ants, and over time the ants are going to win. So, you know, you start out, you get big yields in the beginning, and then, you know, it requires more and more chemicals. The fertility of the soil decreases, and then, you know, you just need more and more inputs, and that's why keeps farmers from advancing, is the increasing cost of the inputs, as well as the degradation in environmental quality, water quality, soil quality, air quality, health of the workers, and all that. So, I think in a very short term, you know, with a really chemically intensive, you know, burst of production, you can get big yields. But over time, I think that the, you know, organic and agroforestry-inspired agriculture will produce a lot more, and that doesn't even take into account all the other benefits of, you know, maintaining water quality, soil health, and also the final products. You know, if all the chemicals that are dumped end up being incorporated into the food items, and then people are eating that, and there are more health problems. So, definitely, we feel that what we're doing is superior. And they're also, you know, in terms of agroforestry, they're also, you know, global implications for stabilizing the climate. And there's been a lot of work that's been done. You know, people at Stanford did a study looking at the mini ice age, which occurred, you know, between 1550 and 1850. And one of the causes of that mini ice age was the decimation of population globally, and, you know, from disease, and that, you know, was the time of a plague, and also the introduction of diseases into the New World, which decimated the indigenous populations. So that actually stopped the farming. And so it was a period of massive reforestation in the Americas and also in Asia, because in the Middle East, because of the plague. That actually caused the temperatures to dip, or that was at least a factor in causing global temperatures to dip. So if we look at that and realize that, you know, that was obviously a tragedy and a terrible loss of culture and life, but if we intentionally started, you know, global reforestation project, and where people are intentionally converting, you know, monoculture and, you know, open spaces into agroforestry, it could have a huge impact in terms of mitigating the you know, climate instability.
Thank you. Can you talk about your bees?
It's a difficult environment for European honeybees in the Amazon. There are so many different types of ants, wasps, and other insects who are just just dying to get into beehives, and the European honeybees aren't really able to defend themselves that well.
Mm.
And so it just takes so much work to protect them. And then the other issue is that, you know, the hives can quickly become Africanized, and then, you know, we have our families were there, our the water buffalo and other could be attacked by Africanized bees, so it creates an issue. So there's an endemic stingless bee, which we've started to work with, and so we're really excited about that because they're endemic, and so they have their own defenses against all the predators, and they don't sting, so they're easy to work with, and the honey is just incredible, and the flavor is so rich, and so we're really excited. We started that project around 6 or 7 months ago, and so we'll see what kind of yields we get and how, you know, we can propagate that, and we're very excited to have, you know, a bee expert, coming to join us over the summer and to help, you know, expand that part of the project.
That sounds fantastic. If you could just explain to the audience the one thing that really makes this all worthwhile. I mean, to do all the things that you're doing is not easy to do, and it's also thankless. You're not getting a day off. Nobody's saying, oh, great job, William. It takes true commitment. At the end of the day, when you look at everything that you've created and everything that you're about to do, what is the one thing that keeps you going?
Well, I think the communities where we work, I mean, just seeing the people being so excited about, you know, being able to restore their land and seeing the destruction that's been, imposed on their land, and seeing that being reversed, and seeing the smiles on their faces, and, you know, having them be independent and also have a good source of income. And it's wonderful to be, with the community and to see the progress we've made.
Thank you. Speaking of which, when it comes to income, how much of what you grow is actually exported at this particular point?
Only a small amount, really. I mean, we grow, I think there are, 12 or 13 different crops we grow. So, you know, we're growing three different types of yucca, which is, a root crop. And that's the staple of the people in the Amazon. So that's, they boil yucca, and that's their starch. So we grow three different types of that. We grow five different types of bananas. That's another staple. So we have big bananas that they boil, and we also have sweet bananas for eating. and we have, we grow a little bit of corn, we grow beans, and then we also grow sweet potatoes. And so those are all things that are sold locally, and also just, that's what we eat. And then things like peppers, the char pica peppers, which are a very small, spicy Amazonian pepper with an incredible flavor. So that's something that is, a regional delicacy. And then there's cocona, which is like a tree tomato. And that they make salsa out of that, which is just incredible. And so that's another regional crop. Achiote, we grow that as well. And then so really our export crops are sachinchi and then cacao, which we grow as part of our agroforestry system.
If someone were to listen to this interview and say, something, I like what he did, I think this is what I want to do as well. Do you have any advice for folks that are listening to this interview that are looking to create their own sustainable farm?
Yes. I think one of the challenges that I think that a lot of NGOs and well-meaning people have is that they involve local communities in projects and without follow-through and without developing a market first. So, the people there, they really will want to increase their income. And so I've seen this a lot in Peru where, NGOs come in, they say, okay, we're going to do this. And, they encourage the people to work so hard and to start producing something. And then after they start producing it, then they say, well, I guess we better find a market for this. And so I would say that, to make sure that you have a secure market first, and then, in that way you can move with confidence to make sure that the community isn't abandoned or doesn't waste all their hard work on a project that isn't financially viable.
Thank you. Now, having said that, you're now beginning to sell product in the United States. What were some of the challenges as far as trying to get into the U.S. market that you experienced?
Well, all the export regulations, there's a lot of bureaucratic challenges in terms of, processing and having all the licensing and doing all that type of work. And then also, also communicating what we're doing and also what sachinchi is. A lot of people still haven't heard of sachinchi and aren't familiar with it. So there's, getting the word out about the health benefits of sachinchi, and as well as, how our sachinchi is produced and, the way that we work and really promoting products from a agroforestry and permaculture system.
If someone were to say to you, William, we like what you're about, we would like to work with you, do you offer any type of partnerships with any other farms that or teaching groups that are looking to learn from people such as yourself?
Oh, absolutely. We have some people, people come to visit, people that have other projects. We have an exchange so people can come and, visit our farms and see what we're doing. And we also like to see other people's farms and, exchange ideas and information. And really, we're very open to, collaboration with other groups. And we're very excited because we're making sachinchi superfood bars. And some of the ingredients we're using from that we're getting from small farmers in the mountains, amaranth, or kiwicha, quinoa, and also inca berries. And so as we develop this, the bars, and we're very excited to expand our farming operations into the mountains and starting to work with some of the communities in the mountains who are also under incredible threat from, mining, hydroelectric projects, and also are some of the poorest people in the Americas are in the mountain valleys of Peru. So we're really excited to expand our work to a different environment, you know, in the Andes.
At this particular point, how many products do you produce that are saleable, especially
well,
to the U.S. market?
We're just getting ready to start retailing our Sachainchi oil, so it's extra virgin mechanical press Sachainchi oil, and also our Sachainchi superfood bars, which are have Sachainchi, figs, amaranth or kiwicha, and maca. So it's a really great bar. And so we'll be starting to retail those at the end of next month. And so we also produce the Sachainchi seeds, which are toasted, and we sell those in bulk. And then, of course, the protein powder, which is the leftover, the mash from the production of the oil. And so that's protein powder, and so that's another product that we're selling.
The protein powder is actually vegan, correct?
That's correct. All our products are vegan.
And they're also gluten-free.
Gluten-free, yes. That's one of the great things about, but also about the kiwicha or amaranth and quinoa is that, they're gluten-free. So it's a great way for people with celiac or people who are just worried about, too much gluten to, get the carbohydrates and protein and everything they need without any gluten.
Just tasting the Sachainchi extra virgin olive oil, it's got a very pleasant aroma, but this is something that should be used as either for a dressing or something or like a dipping sauce or something that does not require cooking because of the tremendous nutritional value of the oil.
That's right, yeah. Sachainchi oil, because it's incredibly rich in omega-3s, it's not a cooking oil. And so you want to use it as a salad oil. So I love to put it on my salads. One of my other favorite things to do is just to eat it with quinoa. So make, steam some quinoa, chop up fresh vegetables, add the vegetables to the quinoa, and dress it with some Sachainchi oil. And the flavor is really incredible. And
thank
also,
you.
People that have the Sachainchi and things that are so rich in omegas and healthy fats can actually help people with cholesterol. So there are some people that have had a lot of success just taking the Sachainchi oil by the spoon as to aid them, they're lowering their triglycerides and cholesterol levels.
I just want to add something that I do myself quite often. If I find an oil that is as pure as the Sachainchi, what I have done in the past is I've actually used it as a topical application, meaning for dry skin, I'll rub it on my elbows, on even on my face, and I find that my skin really loves the oil. I've also used it as a deep conditioner for my hair, and then basically I'll put it on, let it just sit for about 15 minutes, and then I'll take a shower and shampoo and recondition. But I find that as a deep conditioner, it's very effective. But I just want to point out, because before the show, I took some of the Sachainchi oil and just used it topically on my skin. And it's got a very pleasant feeling, not to mention the fact that the fragrance, it's not heavy at all, and it's actually quite pleasant. But I know that with other oils, especially extra virgin oil, it's a very common practice in the Mediterranean. So I'm just curious, is this something that the people in that area use the oil for? Do you know?
Yes, absolutely. The oil has lots of vitamin E, which is it's really beneficial for your skin. And so the local people do actually make some soaps and creams from the Sachainchi oil, and they use it for dry skin or for skin irritations. So there's a great application there for using Sachainchi oil in cosmetics and shampoos and all kinds of different applications. But for now, what we're really focusing on it as a salad oil and a food oil for all the that great omega content.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, do you know if there are any nutritional, if I could say this, nutritional benefits or nutritional value for, say, dogs or cats? Because I know that with the Austrian pumpkin oil, dogs absolutely love it, but I'm just curious. I don't have a dog, but I'm sure if my dog were still around, she would definitely like this. I think she'd like the nuts, too.
Yes, we've been contacted by a number of veterinarians who, are looking for, sources of, vegetable protein for dogs, and so I'm sure that it would be wonderful for, as an application for, for pet foods, and the benefit would be great.
Especially with the high amount of the omegas, the omega-3s. I think that when you find an oil that is high in omega-3s, animals tend to love it also. But I'd be curious to see if you do work with any veterinarians in developing any pet food formulas and what the pet food experts out there have to say, because I know that pet health, especially with some of these superfoods, it's amazing what you can do and how you can really restore your pet's health as well as your own health by looking at the different foods that have been accessible but not necessarily available because of, as you mentioned earlier, different issues with different parts of the world where some of these foods are not available because of all the devastation and destruction that's being done to that actual environment. In regards to the actual product line itself, are you putting up a website so that customers, especially listeners, can try the different products that you're selling?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have our website, ecoola.com. That's ecoola.com, ecoola.com. And right now, if you go to the site, it's focused on our bulk and wholesale business. But starting next month, we'll be offering retail products, so people can go there and shop on our website and try the fat-changing oil, the bars, and the protein powder for themselves. And also, we post on our Facebook page. We often post recipes for the Sachanji oil. We have updates from the farm, lots of images. We have Pinterest and Twitter accounts, also EcoOla. And so, I really encourage people to, look at those venues, and they can follow our progress and also get updates on our product releases.
Is your social media information all the same as everything EcoOla?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. We have many people who listen to the show that are very active on social media, so that's really important because people understand that if you want to connect with groups that you're interested in or people that you want to learn more about, best way to do is social media.
Yeah, so on our Facebook page, we try to do, 3 postings a week generally. And so we have 3 basic themes. One are the, information and updates about, permaculture, agroforestry, also about health issues and nutrition. And then we also have recipes and, innovative ways and great ways to use the products and incorporate them into your daily life. So those are the 3 themes we follow on our Facebook page.
Thank you so much. And, William, it has been wonderful just learning about everything that you're doing. My last question to you is, where do you see this farm 5 years from now? I know that that's got to be a very challenging question, but you are such a visionary, and I'm just curious, what do you have in store for the farm?
Well, one of the things we really want to add is fuel independence. So we're really working hard and, doing a lot of research and preparing to produce our own bioethanol. And I think in 5 years we'll be, producing our own ethanol in a way that, coming from an agroforestry system in a way that will actually be sequestering carbon and producing the fuel at the same time. And so we're really excited about that, and we're also going to be offering more and more products. And we have a list of 220 different fruits that we are already aware of in the jungle, and there are many more hidden superfoods and some incredible things that we're working on. So in 5 years, I think our product line will be a lot bigger, and also our technology in terms of soil building, agroforestry, and particular fuel production will be much more advanced.
I'm sure by then you'll be most likely completely off the grid.
That's our goal. I think we can do that within a 5-year time frame.
I think that's fantastic. I mean, the method of growing the food, the equipment that you use, everything that you're doing, the implementation of integrated pest management into your farming techniques, as well as companion planting, and just so many different things that you're doing to eliminate the need for all of the agrochemicals is just fantastic. And I think that everything that you're doing is just fantastic. And I wish you all the best with the farm. And I look forward to having you back in 5 years to see, okay, well,
I can come back before then. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome, William. And once again, for our audience, can you give our audience your website one more time?
Yes, it's ecoola.com. That's ecoola.com. Ecoola.com.
Thank you, William. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Check out Ecoola's website. And also, you don't like the Sasha Inchi, the oil, the nuts, and the superfood bar is really wonderful, especially if you're a fig lover. The fig has a nice flavor, and it's very crunchy, and it's also a great it's a great food to have, especially if you're looking for something that's nutritious and healthy. So check out the website, and thank you, everyone, for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.